Shrink Wrap Radio number 56, Psychology and Film, October 23rd, 2006. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I mean, you got to realize that in cinema, it's very much a strange process. You pay money to go into a darkened room and relax your being and let somebody else mess with your mind. Show you images and make sounds and music and storylines that they have some idea about, and yet you're open to this. You're very open. This is another connection to the dream state. The body goes into this theta state, which is the same thing that happens in dreams. You're open to suggestion. Mm-hmm. Your body's relaxed. And things can get in there.
That was the voice of my friend and former student, Dr. Tui Wilczynski, who recently completed his doctoral dissertation on film as a medium for personal growth. I first got to know Tui some years back when he was working on a master's degree at Sonoma State University. The two of us are about the same age, and we really clicked when we discovered we were both big fans of folk music and also of good movies. It was later my privilege to be the outside member of Tui's doctoral committee through the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. Tui teaches expressive arts and Sufi dancing in workshops throughout the U.S. and abroad. So let's get into the interview.
Dr. Tui Wilczynski, thanks so much for agreeing to be my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Happy to be here.
And I haven't had too many chances to address you as Dr. Wilczynski, inasmuch as you finished up your doctoral studies fairly recently.
That's right, last June.
Yeah, and how's it been?
I feel like a new person.
Right. Just for our audience, you did your doctoral work at the California Institute of Integral Studies. And what was the title of your doctoral dissertation?
It was called Experiencing and Reflecting on Cinema as a Modality for Personal Growth.
All right. And we'll come back to, some people are probably going to wonder, they're going to say, what, you can get a PhD in that? Well, we'll come back to that question later.
Anytime.
Okay. So let's back up and start somewhere near the beginning. When did it first occur to you that there's a connection between film and psychology that needs to be explored?
Well, if you consider psychology human behavior,
which I do,
that's a pretty broad subject. I mean, that's everything that happens that involves human beings.
Okay.
And one of the things human beings do is they go to movies on occasion.
Yeah.
And even if they don't go to movies, the culture is affected by movies or by cinema or motion pictures, however you want to call it. And they ultimately are affected by it somehow.
That's interesting. There's kind of a feedback loop. As you say that, I get the picture of a feedback loop between culture and cinema, that cinema's depicting culture, but it's also driving it at the same time.
Yeah. You don't know where the chicken or the egg begin.
Yeah.
Movies reflect the culture. They also help create the culture.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting perspective. And your dissertation title, though, talked about personal growth. So I wonder, do you remember what point in time you sort of started to make that connection in your own mind about movies, personal growth?
Well, originally, it wasn't about personal growth. You know how dissertations go, they evolve. You know, like pumpkins on the vine. They may start out as something, and then they become a pumpkin.
Well, I'm thinking actually further back than the dissertation. I'm trying to go back.
I was born at a...
even before you taught your class, there was a glimmer in your mind.
Yeah. Well, I was born at a very young age. And in Brooklyn, New York.
Okay.
And we didn't have much access to media except for motion pictures. And it was sort of a very enlivening part of my life as a youngster.
Mm-hmm.
Years later, I ended up running a cinema in Taos, New Mexico.
Oh, actually, you're running a theater?
Yeah, yeah. And I selected the programs and created the environment of the theater. And after each film, we would have a discussion group. And I noticed that as people discussed the films, they were actually talking about themselves. So they were revealing parts of their own being when discussing the film. So this is where, if you might consider it, psychology enters the picture. People were revealing parts of their being by how their reactions to the film were elicited.
Very, very interesting. And Taos, New Mexico, I guess, was a very... Was this in the 60s, perchance?
This was in the 70s and 80s.
Okay, and so it was a very happening place, right? With it's artists and spirituality and what else?
All kinds of stuff. New Age people, lots of people who've been there for 400 years, a great mix of all kinds of people. Native Americans who'd been there from the dawn of people on this continent. More recent people of Spanish origin, and then the more recent arrivals.
So eventually that experience of running your own, quote, cinema led to you teaching a class on psychology and film. What was the title of that class?
It went through a couple of different manifestations. First it was called probably Psychology and Film, and then it became Cinema as Rorschach. And the reason I use that title is that the same group of people could look at a film and each person would have a different reaction to it. Just as if a group of people looked at a Rorschach card, each one would have a different reaction to it. So that's why I called it that. And then I felt that there was a connection between dreams and cinema. And the course eventually became called Cinema as Collective Dreaming.
Oh, very good. And now you know you're hitting on my, when I'm pushing one of my buttons. And this is a class that you taught, I guess, over several semesters while you were a master's student at Sonoma State University. And I guess even after. And so tell us about the class. How was it structured and what did you hope to accomplish in that class?
Well, during the class, we basically had three parts. In the first part of the class, we would discuss the previous week's film and discuss the film that was coming up. We would watch the film, which took about 2 hours or so. And then afterwards, after a break, we would talk about the film we saw and even do expressive arts processes around the film. We would draw or write about it or work in clay or write poetry and share our reactions to the film.
This is way too much fun to be educational.
It was very educational, and education can be fun.
And so what did you hope to accomplish in that class?
Well, I wanted people to think about their inner life and also their connection to the world at the same time. And I selected films that had the ability to evoke people's reflection on who they were and how they got that way, and also how they related to the world.
Okay, so what films did you choose?
Well, let me give you an idea. Each semester there were different films, but this is sort of a composite list. We showed Zorba the Greek.
Great film. Okay.
Woman in the Dunes, which is a Japanese film. It's also called Sandwoman, I think. Strictly Ballroom, which is a lot of fun. A wonderful series from England called The Singing Detective, which is probably my favorite film. It's actually a seven-hour TV series, but it's...
You turned me on to that, and I did end up watching it.
Shirley Valentine, Seven Samurai, Resurrection, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Never Cry Wolf, another film that's my favorite, King of Hearts, Harold and Maude, Groundhog Day, Cinema Paradiso, and Brazil.
You know, I think I've seen every one of those films.
I'm so glad you did.
And I didn't even take the course.
I love those films.
Because I'm a cinema addict as well. So when you chose those films, was there kind of a topic that you had in mind for each one? Where you did you kind of go into it expecting to, you know, to direct it in a certain way? Or did you just choose them because you liked them?
Well, each film has a slightly different orientation. But again, it comes back to that place I was looking for, a film that would make people think about their lives and about the world. For instance, if you look at King of Hearts, it's a film made about World War I and how people reacted to that. And it's about a town where everyone leaves the town because they hear there are bombs planted in the town. And one soldier, one Scottish soldier, comes into the town. And the people who are in the insane asylum get loose and take over the town.
Right.
And he has no idea that everyone who's personifying all the different roles in town are out of this madhouse.
Uh-huh.
And
just like we don't.
Just like we don't.
Right.
And these people are actually wonderful people and are not into war. And he tries to explain to them about the war, and they're not into it. And he can't imagine why they're not into the war.
Uh-huh.
And it's a wonderful film that reflects on the insanity of war and the power of love and the ability to see illusion and see through illusion.
Okay, let me hear you rhapsodize a little bit about Shirley Valentine.
Shirley Valentine. Shirley Valentine is about a woman who talks to the wall. In other words, she shares her inner thoughts with the audience by talking to the wall. And it's about a woman who has a very compressed life. Her husband and her were used to be very happy and had a joyous relationship, and slowly it got more rigidified and crystallized. And now the life, their lives were set in patterns.
And now she's in midlife, right?
Yeah, yeah. And one day her wealthy neighbor asks her to watch her vegetarian bloodhound. And Shirley Valentine has just gone shopping and gotten a steak for her husband. And she goes by to dog sit the vegetarian bloodhound. And she can see the bloodhound really would like the steak. So she gives the steak to the bloodhound. And when she comes home, she makes her husband eggs and chips that night instead of his usual steak and chips. Now, it's Tuesday night, and they always have steak and chips on Tuesday night. He's very upset about it. He throws the eggs and chips at her.
Oh, my God.
She realizes it's time for a change. And someone tells her about a trip to Greece, and she decides to go to Greece. And during this adventure of going to Greece, she discovers more than Greece. She discovers herself.
Okay. So what kind of discussion would this evoke with the students? What kinds of openings, insights might occur?
Well, all of us get stuck in patterns in our life, even young people, even students. There are certain ways we do things, and we think this is how it always has to be done. Mm-hmm. And here's a film that says you can change. You can change what you're doing and how you're doing things. You can change your perspective on the world. And each person in their writing, and usually they wrote about...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, the requirement for the course was that you wrote about how the film affected you.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we did some expressive arts processes, the key instrument was writing about what it brought up for you.
Yes.
The students weren't just to recreate a synopsis of the film. They were to write about what came up for them.
Okay.
Like it was a stimulus. And let's see what came up for them. So many students wrote about the places in their life or their parents' lives that were stuck.
Uh-huh.
And
writing is kind of a private activity, so they'd be more likely to talk about things that are close to the bone, I think, in the writing than if you just immediately tried to get them to bring it out in discussion.
Yeah. Yeah. They also had time, they had a whole week to think about it and allow inner material to come up.
Yeah. Yeah. Boy, we could go on exploring the list. It would be fun to talk about them, but I think we'll move on. So I gather that while you were teaching this class, at some point you started collecting some qualitative data from the students, which you were later able to use for your doctoral dissertation. So what sorts of information did you seek from the students?
Well, originally I was interested in writing about the relationship between dream and cinema. And during the process of dissertationism, you might want to call it academia, it's another phrase for it, the topic changed, and I was required to change it, and it evolved into a new form.
As does happen.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah.
And the new form asked me to do more of an analytical process than my more expansive theoretical process. So the students' papers were a vast wealth of information about their reactions. And I found out about a process called grounded theory, which is actually a sociological technique. And I used that to look at the papers. And the process is sort of a process of refinement. First, you look at the papers and you see what topics come up. An interesting part was that you have to get lots of different colored highlighters.
Yeah, because you had coding them, right?
I really checked that every store that had highlighters. You wouldn't believe the colors you have.
Yeah.
In fact, I ran out of categories. I mean, I ran out of colors, so I had to use like two different colors or stripes and circles. But some way to, so I started delineating the different topics that appeared, and then you slowly condense them down into a certain number of topics. And then from that, you find elements that link up various topics, and then from that you can condense a more generalized idea of what's going on.
Okay, so basically it was the student papers that served as the raw data for the study, and then you went in and you with as open-minded a way as you could, without having sort of preset categories in your mind, you tried to see what themes leapt out at you.
Yeah, you define your own biases at first, so you're aware of them. Of course, being human beings, we always have biases.
Right.
I think there was an article, a paper published years ago by Rosenthal and Rosenthal, that it said if you have any study involving human beings, it's going to be some kind of bias. Even if it's double, triple blind, there's going to be some kind of effect happening on, because human beings communicate so well, even unconsciously. So this method says, yeah, there is some kind of bias, but let's look at it, let's notice it, and let's look at the what comes up.
Yeah. Now, what you really wanted to do in the first place was talk about dreams and cinema, dreams and film, or films, film and dream.
Just briefly,
what was your notion? What was your hypothesis about
that? Okay, well, they're both visual phenomena for the most part.
Good point.
I mean, you see, usually in dreams, some people have other things going on in dream, but for the most part, people see a series of images. In dreams, they're self-generated. In movies, they're generated by the director of the film and the whole process. At the same time, some directors have said they're just listening to the zeitgeist. They're listening to what's going on in the culture. So it could be that the directors who are clued into that are actually presenting cinema that is responding to people's consciousness.
Or to the collective unconscious in the way that mythology did in the past. Because you know, we don't have myths that we recognize as myths today very much.
Yeah.
But we are really immersed in the world of cinema.
And there's a lot of there's a lot of unconsciousness in making films. Films that are just made to make economic gain. And some of them are affecting people in awful ways because they just want to get people to come in and experience it. And the lowest common denominator is very often used. So I look for films that were not like that, that films that had some way of having you look at yourself.
They had an artistic dimension. They had a dimension of truth and universality. Because, I like what you're saying. And definitely there are films that achieve that, and there are ones that don't. And the ones that achieve it perhaps also achieve tapping into the collective unconscious in ways that the creator may not even realize, but that we might come back 25, 50 years later, look at that and realize, oh my God, that foreshadowed what was going to happen just, you know, 10 years later.
Yeah. In a way, it's like we're like the fish swimming in water trying to examine the water. Films have such an effect on our culture. Let me give you an example, okay?
Yes.
In the 20s, I believe 20s and 30s, the De Beers Company, this is an African company that made diamonds, diamonds, came to Hollywood and bribed with diamonds the directors, writers, producers to have a scene in every movie where the ingenue would have a big diamond ring and say, "Look, he loves me." And she showed all of her friends, and people started getting the idea that you had to give someone a large diamond engagement ring. That wasn't part of our culture before that time. This was injected into our culture by the De Beers Company so that people would now, and now in our culture, every young man will spend maybe a year or two of his salary buying a rock for his sweetheart.
Yeah.
And that was done through the cinema.
Right. Right. And now, of course, there are these glaring product placements that are just mm-hmm. so much more obvious than it. Yeah. At least they were subtle there. They were a little bit covert.
Yeah, it's the subtle stuff that's even stronger, like smoking, for instance.
Yeah.
Right now, at least in California, smoking has gotten very diminished, but you still see films where people are smoking or talking about their longing to smoke, or there'll just be scenes of people relaxing and smoking, even though people know it's going to cause difficulty. If I was just in the UK, and when you buy a pack of cigarettes there, in big black letters it says, smoking kills, right on the package.
Wow, wow.
Here it's the more subtle thing. This contains carbon monoxide.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're pretty blatant about it. But they still sell them, and people still buy them.
Yeah. Okay, I think we've drifted a bit off topic here.
That's okay.
In terms of our main focus. Now, I know one phase of the doctoral dissertation involves a literature review. Did you find much of a literature on film and psychology?
I did, actually. One of the most interesting aspects had to do with the training of medical students. There is a group that discovered that medical students sometimes had a hard time relating to homeless people. But when they saw a movie that depicted doctors taking care of homeless people, they developed more compassion.
Interesting.
And there was a direct connection to watching the film to how these students acted afterwards.
Okay.
So that's more of a positive effect.
Yeah, yeah.
There was another person who collected films that had to do with increasing paranoia in the culture and noticed that students had more paranoia after watching the film. So I looked at films that had neither of those qualities, but I wouldn't mind increasing compassion in the world since we need that.
Yeah.
But the films I selected were more about films that would have you notice your own being.
I just came across a book that I think you might be interested in, very catchy title, and I think I might try to track the authors down for an interview at some point. It's written by a couple of therapists who use cinema as part of their treatment. And it's got this great title, Rent Two Films and Let's Talk in the Morning.
Sounds very medical to me.
Yeah.
There are people who do prescribe films. We do it to our friends.
Yes,
you know,
we do.
If someone's in a certain state, well, you ought to see this.
Yeah.
It'll show you that about yourself or something. Mm-hmm. We do it automatically. It's become like books used to be.
Yes.
It's replaced for a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of people have stopped reading. And they do watch movies.
Okay. Or they listen to podcasts.
This is happening right now. Right?
Which is good.
Okay.
So
You got to realize that in cinema, it's very much a strange process. You pay money to go into a darkened room and relax your being and let somebody else mess with your mind. Show you images and make sounds and music and storylines that they have some idea about, and yet you're open to this. You're very mm-hmm. open. This is another connection to the dream state. The body goes into this theta state, which is the same thing that happens in dreams. You're open to suggestion. Mm-hmm. Your body's relaxed, and things can get in there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's, again, another whole road that we could go down, and it would be it'd be an interesting one to explore more. This is the whole thing about manipulation through film, propagandizing, etc. How about giving us a little summary? I say little because it is a dissertation. Give us a little summary of your dissertation findings.
Well, the groups of related experiences that appeared in the students' papers were called theme clusters.
Okay.
Let me give an example of some of them. These are the things that come up. They come up for all people, but this is the ones that happen in the classes. Experiencing emotions, learning lessons, provoking curiosity, projecting, mirroring life experience, nostalgia or memories, awakening self-examination and exploration, reflecting on the very process of viewing cinema, opinions about specific movies, reflecting on the culture and the society, generalizing, extrapolating, noticing your biases, notice the effect of mood that you have when you watch a certain film. Mm-hmm. You can watch a certain film in two different moods and have two different experiences. Confessing, therapy and catharsis, escape, perceptions which vary with time, That's pretty much a list of the things that came up.
Okay, and then you had instances illustrating each of those kinds of themes.
And these things got condensed down. These theme clusters got condensed into another group, which was sort of a distillation. These are called consistent themes. These are words that come from grounded theory.
Okay.
So the theme clusters evolved into six consistent themes, which were self-awareness and healing, analogies of real experience, becoming conscious of issues, learning, cinematic awareness, and escape.
Escape.
Many of us go to the films for escape.
I would never do that.
Yeah. In fact, there's a cartoon.
I'm one of the most compulsive film goers around, as you know. Second only, maybe, to you.
I'm not that compulsive these days. But there's a cartoon I have. It shows you a guy going into a movie house with a bag of popcorn, and he said, gee, I can't remember what film I came in here to see. And the next picture says, I can't remember what day it is. And then he says, I can't remember who I am. And then he says, it doesn't get any better than this.
Ego loss. Very good. Well, backing away from the film stuff a bit, you have a very interesting life. You're leading a very interesting life these days. And you always have, as a matter of fact, from what I know of you. You've just returned from Scotland, I understand. What were you doing there?
I was at a place called Finhorn in northern Scotland, a marvelous place. And I was visiting friends and doing some teaching.
And what were you teaching?
I was teaching the dances of universal peace, as well as using the expressive arts as ways to look at our specific personal journeys.
Yeah, and I know that you do a lot of dance teaching. And this is remarkable, because I should share with the audience, they can't see you as I see you right now, and you don't have your artificial leg on at this moment. So we have a one-legged dance teacher.
I am a one-legged dance teacher.
And that almost sounds like a joke or a punchline of a joke.
God knows, or goddess knows.
But in fact, you're in great demand for your services as a dance teacher.
Relatively, yes.
Yeah, it's sort of pulled you to a number of different places around the country and around the world.
Yeah. It's not just being a dance teacher. It's more like being a facilitator of a certain kind of experience, mm-hmm. which are called Dances of Universal Peace, which is rooted in a universalist Sufi tradition.
Right. You are a Sufi, right?
I'm on that path.
You're on the Sufi
path. But I'm on a certain kind of Sufi path. It's a universalist one. There are many kinds of Sufis, like you have many kinds of Christians or many kinds of Jews. This is a universalist one that honors all traditions.
Uh-huh.
And music and dance are part of the ways that people work together, pray together.
Yeah. You know, I've interviewed people about meditation, about Buddhism, and this is the first conversation that we've had about Sufism. Isn't the poet Rumi? He comes out of that Sufi tradition, doesn't he?
Rumi definitely is.
Yeah.
And he's created his own tradition. Rumi is wonderful.
Are you one of these people who can recite Rumi?
I probably can, but off the top of my head, it's not coming. But the other person I can recite is Hafiz, who was born about 100 years after Rumi and is in the same tradition.
Uh-huh.
This is a short poem by Hafiz, and he says, even after all this time, the sun never says to the earth, you owe me. Look what a love like that can do. It lights up the whole sky.
Good one. Yes, I hope everybody out there has been exposed to the poetry of Rumi, and I've heard
Hafiz. Hafiz.
Yeah, of Hafiz as well. And it is very much an ecstatic tradition of ecstatic relation to
the divine,
to the divine,
yeah.
To life.
It's a path of the heart. Path of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, all paths lead to the same place, but this one particularly uses the heart as the way to perceive the world.
Yeah. And you first got, what, inducted into this?
Inducted.
I can't think of the right
very
word.
Militaristic.
I know, it's not
initiated.
The right word. And drawn into by a well-known character during the period, by the name of Sufi Sam, right?
Yes.
Can you tell us about
Sam Lewis, Murshid Sam Lewis, was a wonderful being. He lived in San Francisco. He traveled the world, and everywhere he went, he was recognized as a great teacher. If he went to a Zendo, they called him the Roshi. If he went to a monastery, he was called the abbot. If he went to a Jewish community, he was called the rabbi. And he had this great, wonderful awareness and depth of heart that was recognized by everyone.
And sense of humor, too, right?
Great sense of humor. And also he somehow got the message that in the 60s there was a great need for spiritual return in many people, a way to focus their spiritual energy. And he decided to get the teach the hippies how to dance. And it became, it evolved into a tradition, Dances of Universal Peace, which is now all around the world.
And you've really helped carry that tradition on.
I hope I have.
Yeah, yeah. And you you were with Ram Dass for some number of years, weren't
yeah.
you?
Yeah, I traveled with him. I was his, you might say, a song and dance man for a little while. Mm-hmm. And I led the dances and led music with him.
So, some number of our listeners are students who are interested in psychology, some probably young students and other adult students returning to school, as you were when we first met. And you've had an interesting scholastic career. Why don't you kind of take us through it?
Well, I started in the sciences, in mathematics and chemistry and physics, and was searching for the humanities through the sciences and got into biology and then psychology and took my BA in New York in psychology, I think with a minor in mathematics.
Okay, and that was where?
CUNY, City University of New York at Brooklyn College.
Okay, great.
And then I was interested in music therapy, and I was studying at Cal State Long Beach. And then I came up to Sonoma County and was continuing in my music studies but got interested in the psychology program. Mm-hmm. So I took my master's in psychology there. And then I went on to the California Institute for Integral Studies and got my doctorate there.
And you were in a program there that was called East-West Studies, right?
Well, I went through a couple of programs there.
Oh, okay.
And the last one was sort of in more of an individualized program.
Okay. Okay, great.
But they do the school itself has the quality of integrating East and West.
Right. Well, do you have any last thoughts that you'd like to leave with our audience?
Well, the last thing you mentioned about students, new students... there's a story, I think it's a Sufi story, maybe it's a kind of cosmic story. Someone asked the teacher, the great guru, and says, how do I get enlightened? And the teacher says, well, you get that way from having good judgment. And he says, how do I have good judgment? You have that from experience. Well, how do I have experience? You have experience from bad judgment. So, face life. Jump right in. It's all grist for the mill.
Ah, that's the message. Okay. Like Zorba the Greek.
Like Zorba the Greek.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Tui Wilczynski, thanks so much for being our guest here on Shrink Wrap Radio. And as I've said to others, you can consider yourself shrunk and wrapped.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Tui Wilczynski. I can tell you he's a lot of fun in person. He usually has a merry twinkle in his eye, and he can be counted on for his ever-expanding repertoire of stories and jokes. While I've never taught a course on psychology and film, I have, myself, long used a variety of Hollywood and foreign films in my teaching. One in particular comes to mind, which I was using right up to my retirement 2 years ago. The class was called Human Potential, and the film is Once We're Warriors. While the primary emphasis of my Human Potential class was on our positive potential, I thought it was also important to give a nod to our negative potential, which is more than evident in the world. Once We're Warriors is one of the most powerful films I've ever seen, and it illustrates much of what can go wrong in families. It graphically deals with such issues as alcohol and drug abuse, wife beating, sexual abuse of children, and gang violence, among other themes. Even more particularly, it shows what happens to Aboriginal cultures when they're impacted by our so-called civilization. Over and over again across the world, we've seen that the original culture is marginalized by the dominant culture. The Aboriginal culture begins to question their own story, their own myth, as it's invalidated and disempowered by the dominant culture. And inevitably, it seems the Aboriginal culture then devolves into alcoholism, drug addiction, crime, and marital and spousal abuse, dependency, and a host of other problems. When I say Aboriginal culture, I'm not referring solely to the Australian Aborigines, but to the American Indians and other such original groups around the planet. In the case of Once Were Warriors, the story is set in urban Auckland, New Zealand. And this movie tells the story of an urban Maori family. The father, Jake, is a violent man who beats his wife frequently when drunk and yet obviously loves both her and his family. And the movie follows a period of several weeks in the family's life, showing Jake's frequent outbursts of violence and the effect that this has on everyone in the family. And his youngest son is in trouble with the police and may be put in a foster home, while the older son is about to join a street gang. Meanwhile, Jake's daughter, Gracie, is sexually abused by her father's best friend, and it goes on and on. A high point in the film is when a male social worker, who's also Maori, takes the delinquent son in hand and connects him to his cultural and spiritual roots by teaching him and other delinquent boys Maori dances and discipline. The film, which came out in 1994, is based on a book by Alan Duff, and I must confess I've not read the book. It's hard to believe that the book could be any more powerful than this film, though. Some of my young women students felt it too upsetting to watch and questioned my decision to show it. Yet I felt and continue to feel that this film brings to life the dilemmas faced by so many disenfranchised people in our world today. If you haven't seen this film, and you're tough enough to take it, I highly recommend it. You'd be able to find it in top-notch video rental stores or to get the DVD online. There's another film I've used in my teaching in recent years, and it's called Waking Life by Art Linklater. I somehow missed this one when it was in the theaters in 2001, but in recent years, students kept suggesting it as a great resource, particularly for my course on myth, dream, and symbol. The technique used to film it gives it a very dreamlike quality, and in large part, it seems to be a depiction of what we call lucid dreaming, that is, being conscious of the fact that you are dreaming while you're in the dream. Let me read to you a bit of what Wikipedia has to say about this most thought-provoking film. According to Wikipedia, in a broad scope, Waking Life is about a young man in a persistent dreamlike state. The film follows its protagonist as he initially observes and later participates in philosophical discussions that weave together issues like appearance and reality, free will, our relationships with others, and the meaning of life. Along the way, the film touches on other topics, including existentialism, posthumanism, and the film theory of André Bazin. The young man eventually comes to the realization that he's dreaming and that he is unable to wake up. By the end of the film, he fears that he might be dead. Unsurprisingly, given the above themes and content, Waking Life is much more focused on dialogue, often even monologue, than on plot action. In this emphasis, it echoes the 1981 film My Dinner with André, another great film, and the 1990 film Mind Walk, which students keep recommending to me. Long scenes in Waking Life consist of nothing but headshots of characters while they expound on some philosophical idea, sometimes illogically. The characters and their speech are very reminiscent of Linklater's earlier cult classic, Slacker, which starred Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, even appear in their characters from Linklater's Before Sunrise, kind of a prequel vision. Adding to the dreamlike effect, the film used an innovative animation technique. Animators overlaid live-action footage with animation that roughly approximates the images actually filmed. A variety of artists were employed, so the feel of the movie continually changes. The result is a surreal, shifting dreamscape. And I'll skip some. It says nominated for numerous awards, mainly for its technical achievements. Waking Life won the National Society of Film Critics Award for Best Experimental Film, the New York Film Critics Circle Award for Best Animated Film, and the Cinem Avenire Award at the Venice Film Festival for Best Film. It was also nominated for the Golden Lion, the festival's main award. So, those are Dr. Dave's video picks for today.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
In relation to that little ditty, I received a nice email from Ken Valerio, author and artist, who writes, "Hey, Dr. Dave, I just thought it would make you happy to know that two times in the last week, I've caught myself singing your theme song and couldn't get it out of my head. It's catchy." Thank you, Ken. That's just what we're hoping for, is mass brainwashing. He goes on to write, "I just listened to the episode about the brain, and I was happy that you expressed your skepticism. I, too, am skeptical, as I feel that no matter how much we know about the brain, we are still left with the human condition. The optimism of some scientists is a bit naive, I think. The question of functional behavior and how that relates to the functioning of society, although it is a philosophical issue, some might say, I find that many psychologists are happy to avoid it. I always like how Martin Luther King Jr. talks about being maladaptive to injustice and maladaptive to inequality. Just some thoughts. Hope you're well, Ken." Hey, Ken, thanks so much for that comment, and as I say, I'm glad to hear our brainwashing efforts are having some success. While we're on this tack, let's move on to some other emails. We hear, "Dr. Dave, I wanted to write you a note to let you know how incredible your show is. You're so calm and soothing that sometimes it's hard to believe you're touching on some of the most politically heated and unconventional, parentheses scary to the rest of the world, close parentheses, topics I've ever heard broadcasted. Keep up the great work, Jonathan H. in Las Vegas." And then he writes, "P.S. I'm really interested in fiction writing and how authors come up with their ideas, plot, characters, prose, etc. Is there any way you can work this into a segment, or can you suggest some reading for me? Thanks." Hey, Jonathan, thank you for that note, and thanks for acknowledging that, in fact, we do touch on some politically heated and unconventional topics. And I am able to do that in a calm and cool and collected way, which actually relates to why I was a successful department chair for 7 years. Thanks, too, for your suggestion about finding somebody who I could interview about the process of writing fiction. It actually gave me a brainstorm of trying to contact somebody like Jonathan Kellerman, who is a very successful mystery writer, who is a psychologist, and the hero of his novels is a psychologist. I have no idea how I would track this guy down, but that would sure make for a good show, I think. Actually, I guess the way to go about it would be to figure out who his publisher is and contact the publisher and let them know that I'm interested in an interview. And who knows, maybe I would get a response. So another item goes on to my to-do list. I was happy to hear from this new listener who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm currently doing a Bachelor of Counseling in Human Change in Sydney, Australia. I have many life and work experiences, and I'm now getting a degree to cement them together. I'm 45 years young and loving your show." I'm so glad to hear that. "I'm just starting out in a new business, which combines my 16 years of sobriety and other qualifications. My business is Recovery Coach International, and I have a website at recoverycoach.com.au, but we're still building it. I'm helping people get established and be supported while they grow on their recovery journey. Using telephony and the internet, my customer base can then be the same as your podcast venue, the whole world. Truly amazing. Every morning I go for a lovely bush walk and listen to mostly your podcasts. They are a great way to start the day and to combine the physical and mental alongside the inspiring feelings I get from being surrounded by nature. You have a knack of choosing great people to interview, and it's always informative as well as entertaining. You know, by the way, that's one of the kicks I get out of doing this show, is choosing people to interview. And that's kind of fun, and it's like going fishing, particularly when I go after the people that I don't know, and I'm sort of contacting them out of the blue, and I'm trying to catch a big fish, and it's very exciting when I land the big fish, as I will for my very next show, by the way. Back to the email. She writes, "Since I'm embarking on my new venture, I would like to request a theme for an interview. What is the cutting-edge approach to treating addiction recovery? Who is the leader in the field? I love to hear from the best of the best and then to model them. Then you can interview me in a couple of years' time." Ha ha. "Keep up the great work, Dr. Dave. The world needs you. Cheers, Atlanta." What a great name that is, Atlanta. Never encountered that as a person's name before, and I really like it. And that's a wonderful suggestion to find an addiction expert. I have to say that off the top of my head, I don't know who the best of the best is in that area. If any listener out there does know, I'd be open to those suggestions. I think it's a dynamite idea for a show.
"Hello, Dr. Dave. My name is Penpen, and I got a question about hypnosis. There is a famous hypnotizer in my country which has an audience that always states, that audience always states that they were totally unaware of the things that were going on. Therefore, it enables the hypnotizer to let them do things that they would never do if they would be fully aware or even semi-aware of the things going on. On the other hand, there is a hypnotherapist that says that being hypnotized is being in a kind of trance in which you are, I would say, semi-conscious. That means, for example, as she gives the example herself, being in an elevator, looking at the number display, and forgetting the people around you and the conversations going on around you. It is clear that we are looking at two different levels of consciousness. One is basically a level in which you are unconscious. The other one is a level of, I would say, semi-consciousness. Now, my question is, what is hypnotherapy about? What kind of conscious level should I maintain during a session? Has there been any research about different kinds of levels of people during a hypnosession? Thanks for answering my question beforehand. Keep up the good work." That means your podcasting, of course. Bye for now.
Pan, that's an excellent question. I'm not sure I can give a simple and totally definitive answer. I have a friend who maintains a database of hypnosis research, and I'm going to try to get her on as a guest at some point. Currently, here's what I know or think I know on the subject. There's a big difference between stage hypnosis and clinical hypnosis. Stage hypnosis is designed to entertain and also to heighten the illusion of getting people to do things they could not or would not do otherwise. However, some years back, Theodore Barber and his students showed over quite a long string of experiments that there is no feat that a person can do under hypnosis that a person could not be induced to do under motivated but non-hypnotic conditions, including things like having their head and shoulders on one chair and their feet on another and having the hypnotist or the experimenter stand on their chest. Stage hypnotists are very skilled in, one, picking people who are very suggestible and who are motivated to go along with the entertainment, and two, wording their instructions in a no-fail sort of way so that no matter what happens, they won't look bad. Furthermore, when you volunteer to go up on stage as a subject, there's a lot of pressure both from the audience and from the hypnotist for you to just go along. There's also a lot of permission to be silly, stupid, and funny. The people who volunteer likely have strong exhibitionistic desires, whether consciously or not. People will say that they were not aware of what they were doing or that they don't remember, but in fact, we have only their report to go by. There is no objective way to verify their report. Now, in the clinical situation, most people experience hypnosis as a fairly light and undramatic state of relaxation, or even a deeper state of relaxation. However, they usually know what's going on and can pull themselves out or refuse suggestions if they want to. A relatively small percentage of people report a much more dramatic internal experience. Most people who do hypnotherapy will probably say that depth or the experience of being deeply under is not critical to clinical success. Because we're talking about non-verifiable subjective experience, from a scientific point of view, there are a lot of tough methodological questions around all of this. As hypnotist, am I controlling you, or are you controlling me? Inasmuch as everything I do will be predicated on the responses you're showing me and the feedback you're giving me, it could be said that you, the hypnotic subject, are controlling me. I advise some caution in regard to non-professionals experimenting with hypnosis. My reason is that there are people who have strange and disturbing experiences without hypnosis, or for whom those types of experiences are close to the surface, a bad trip, if you will. If somebody has a bad trip when you are supposedly in control and therefore responsible, what are you going to do? You're not really in control. None of us truly has control over another's internal experience. Back when I was a student and earlier in my career, I disregarded the above advice, and 99% of the time there was never a problem. But there were a few times when I saw some rather weird and potentially disturbing responses, enough to give me pause not to be quite so blithe about it. So I think that's all I can say today without taking up a whole lot of time on the subject, but maybe we'll get deeper into it if I am able to entice that guest that I mentioned to be on the show. So that'll wrap it up for email for now. That is, other than to give you the post-podcast suggestion that GoDaddy is the go-to place for all your internet needs and that you can find fabulous discount codes at shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Sylvia from LA, and you're on the couch, on a rock, on a boat, on a plane, with Dr. Dave.
Now, there's a voice that could put me into a trance, and a happy one at that. Hey, I'd love to hear from you with your emails, which you can send to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And don't forget, you can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod, or alternatively, you can leave voice messages like PanPan did on MyChingo, and you'll find a link to that on our ShrinkWrap Radio website. We have two new additions to our Frapper map. Let me welcome Sabrina in Winnipeg, Canada, and Atlanta in Sydney, Australia, to our ShrinkWrap Radio community. If you haven't put yourself on our map yet, please do so. You'll find a link at shrinkwrapradio.com. Even more importantly, however, I really need you to take our new listener survey. I expected an avalanche of responses after announcing it on the last show, but alas, at this point, we only have 11 completed surveys. The statistics don't become meaningful until I get well over 100, so I'm hoping you'll help out. I know there are more than 100 people listening. It only takes a couple of minutes, and your feedback will really help to sustain the show and also helps to shape it in the ways you want. You'll find the link to the survey on the show's pages at shrinkwrapradio.com, or you can go directly to the survey right now at www.shrinkwrapradio.com/ survey.htm. Now, I really have to apologize to the first two people to respond to the survey request. Because of a technical screw-up, I lost those first two pieces of data. If you completed the survey and yours is not among the following names, would you please be so kind as to do it again? Here are the first names of the completed surveys that I have so far. Gary, Joan, Tom, Zom, spelled Z-O-M, Cody, K-O-T-Y, I know I'm not saying it right, Brian, John, spelled J-O-N, Tom, Gerald, and Pan Pan. Plus, there was one more person who didn't give their name. I really want to thank you, First 11, and I'm looking forward to hearing from the rest of you. Well, that wraps up today's podcast. Thanks again to my good friend, Dr. Tui Wilczynski. We close with a PodSafe instrumental titled Love Theme from My Movie by Tim Jennings. And you'll find a link to this tune in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com, where you can support this artist by downloading it for only 99 cents. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.